Welcome back to the Nutrition Unmeasured podcast. I'm your host, Gina Forster, a dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor from Columbus, Ohio. Today's sponsor is actually my personal intuitive eating and wellness program. Allow me to be your personal coach through the 10 principles of intuitive eating. During this journey, you'll receive a workbook to have throughout, a helpful body positivity journal, access to me at any time, and bi-weekly one-on-one calls to keep you accountable to yourself and motivated to change and find peace with food in your body. Before getting started today, I'd love to ask for a review if you're really enjoying this podcast. Reviews only take a few seconds, and they really help me grow the listenership, so of course, I would appreciate it so much. Just some updates since our last, since my last episode all about my favorite, really nonfiction wellness, intuitive eating, body trust books. Actually, it is my kids' spring break officially when this episode comes out. We will be getting ready to go on a little trip. I am very excited about it. We're actually going with two other families, so families that we're close with that we've traveled with before. I don't know, the kids being the ages that they are, we just really have found that traveling with other families who have similar aged kids has just been really fun for us. It kind of gives us a little vacation too, instead of having to always entertain the kids, which, you know what, take that as you will. I'm not trying to say that I don't love to be with my kids, because obviously I do very much. But, you know, sometimes vacation, it's nice to have a little break and let them be entertained by their friends. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that whatsoever. So that's what we're doing. We have a house that has an indoor pool and a hot tub, so they will be entertained with that as well, and lots of fun things to do in this house. So it'll be, I think, a lot of fun, and then we'll be in a really cool place that where there's also plenty to do, including a Titanic museum, which I don't know if I've mentioned this, but Cameron, who just turned 7, is, or at least went through a Titanic obsession phase. I don't know. I think maybe he's kind of out of it now, but I think he's going to get back into it after we go to this museum. I'm really excited about it. We just bought tickets to make sure that we get to see that while we're there. And yeah, we'll be doing a lot of other fun stuff as well, hiking outside and just really enjoying, hopefully, the beautiful weather. All right, I'm going to introduce you to Megan Lyons, who I am interviewing today. Megan Lyons is a sought-after health and wellness expert who is deeply passionate about inspiring others to feel their healthiest and happiest. Megan is a Harvard graduate, MBA, and former management consultant who left the business world to follow her passion for wellness by opening the Lyons Share Wellness in 2014. Since then, she's earned a master's degree in holistic nutrition and become double board certified in holistic nutrition and clinical nutrition. She is currently pursuing a doctorate of clinical nutrition and has amassed over 10,000 hours of one-on-one nutrition consulting with clients internationally. Megan is the author of Start Here, 7 Easy Diet-Free Steps to Achieve Your Ultimate Health and Happiness, a top 10 Amazon bestseller in nutrition, and she runs a top podcast on health and wellness called Wellness Your Way with Megan Lyons. Her Revitalize Health Accelerator is a community of health-minded individuals looking to continually up-level their health and wellness. Now, before getting into this amazing interview with Megan all about gut health, I just want to make a note that the interview, I had some issues with my recording. It sounds like after I went back to listen to it, that it was my computer picking up my voice, not my microphone. So I apologize. This is not the most crisp interview, but either way, it's a great one. And I hope you enjoy Megan as much as I enjoyed, you know, having the time to interview her and really learn from her.
All right. I'm so excited to have Megan Lyons here on my podcast. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be talking with you today.
Yes, likewise. I'm really grateful, especially that we're talking about something that, as I said before jumping on this interview, I feel pretty confident in my knowledge about gut health and probiotics, etc. But I can always use more information. I very much am an intuitive eating, general health type dietitian. I've never actually really dove into specifics in any area of nutrition. I don't know. I'm sure you've heard of the low FODMAP diet, but a long time ago in my dietetics career, I did help people follow like an IBS low FODMAP diet, but I have kind of, I don't know, I feel like I've lost some of my gut health knowledge. So I'm really glad that you're here to answer some of the questions that I have that I think would also be helpful for listeners. But before I get started,
I'm glad too.
Yes, thank you. And I was saying before too, and we'll put the notes in the show notes, but you have some great gut health podcasts on your podcast as well. So we'll make sure to link those if after this interview people have more questions, which I feel like that always happens with me. I listen to an interview to learn something and it's like I actually leave with more questions, but in the best way, you know?
Yes, I do know.
So just some icebreaker questions. I always do this just to kind of get to know you and for listeners to get to know you. We'll start with, all right, Megan, what is your favorite food of all time?
Oh, absolutely chocolate. No questions asked. I love chocolate. I have chocolate every single day. I am fortunate that I really like dark chocolate. And it's just such a highlight of my day, honestly, to sit and savor and mindfully eat that chocolate. It's awesome. Mm. I also genuinely love roasted Brussels sprouts. So it kind of sounds weird to do chocolate and Brussels sprouts together. Mm. I don't necessarily do chocolate covered Brussels sprouts, but that would be probably a close second.
Wow. We had someone here, I've had some people say lentils and chickpeas, also broccoli. Oh. So Brussels sprouts.
Wow, we're in good company.
Exactly. It sounds like you like bitter foods.
I do. I am thankfully, because obviously I love those foods, not a bitter super taster. So All of the bitter stuff, it just tastes great to me.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I love like extra dark chocolate, extra hoppy beer, very bitter vegetables. And I'm thankful that I am not a bitter super taster as well. And for those who don't know what we're talking about, some people, I think it's just like if you have more taste buds, I don't know what exactly the mechanism is, but some people just can taste bitter very, very well. And therefore, they're less likely to like those types of foods, which often tend to be the more healthy foods or, you know, like the more nutritious foods. So we aren't super tasters in that regard, which I think is in some ways very good. Like you said.
Yes. Lucky.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't mean if you're a bitter super taster that you can't like, you know, nutrient dense foods at all, but.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. There are plenty of vegetables and other nutrient dense foods that are not bitter.
Right.
I like those too. I just happen to really like the bitter ones.
Yes, yes, ditto. Okay, best vacation that you've ever taken or just best place that you've visited?
Oh, wow. Best vacation I've ever taken for sure was my honeymoon. My husband and I had this amazing opportunity where we got married in between our jobs, our first jobs out of college and going to business school. We both went to get our MBA together. And so we got like a summer break as an adult, which doesn't happen normally, but we had this long extended period of time. And I had been doing management consulting, which for people who don't know, you travel a lot. You travel 48 weeks a year. So I got lots of hotel points and miles and all this stuff. And we were able, based on the time and the points and all of that, we were able to do an 11-country, 40-day honeymoon, which was just a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And I could never stop being grateful for all those amazing places.
Wow. Okay, 11 countries. So which was your favorite?
My favorite? Oh, that's so hard. I think my I don't know what you would call it, underdog favorite, because I underestimated it before we went, was Norway. I had zero expectations of Norway, honestly. I didn't even really know what we were going to see, but it was beautiful. The people were so nice. There was so much to see. It was just amazing.
Oh, yeah. I would love to go to Norway. My sister-in-law went to Norway with her partner last year, and I was with them over winter break, and heard a lot of great things and would love to go sometime. So good. That sounds like an amazing trip for sure. All right, let's take a 180 here and let's dive into some gut health. So I guess just to kind of top off the interview, I think it's important just to talk a little bit about gut health. Like you hear this all the time. It's good for your gut health. It's just like one of those things that's constantly being touted on in magazines, online, on the TV. So what exactly is the gut and what constitutes gut health? And then also, why is it so important? That's a long question. Yeah.
Yes. Well, great questions. I'll try not to do too long of an answer, but I love talking about gut health. So we could make this a 20-hour podcast if we wanted to. Don't worry, audience, we won't.
Yeah.
But gut health is when people say, oh, my gut's fine, they're thinking what comes out in the toilet looks kind of normal to me. Now, that might be an indication, but also I have plenty of clients say to me, oh, yeah, I'm regular. And then I ask them, well, how often are you having a bowel movement? And they say, oh, you know, every 4 or 5 days. And I silently gasp inside and get excited by how much better they'll feel when they're having more truly regular every day or maybe multiple times a day bowel movements. But it doesn't even have to be just what's in the toilet. Some people can have gut health that is not optimal, but they might be truly regular. They're having one bowel movement per day or something like that. And the gut itself is a huge tube from the mouth to the anus that has several different parts. It's your mouth, it's your esophagus, it's your stomach, it's your small intestine, large intestine, all of that kind of stuff. And this is the home to so much other important stuff aside from just what comes out in the toilet. Many people have heard that 70% or more of your immune system is in your gut, because if we think about it, where do we get most of the pathogens we encounter? It's from our food. Our immune system has to be ready there to squash any kind of adverse thing that we eat. So our immune system strength is very related to our gut health, and then our mental health as well. 80% or more of the serotonin, which is one of the happy hormones in your body, is actually manufactured in your gut, not your brain. So if you don't have those great bacteria living in your gut, you can't make as many of the good neurotransmitters and hormones that your brain needs to function optimally. So it's not just about the toilet. It's about your immune system. It's about your mental health. It's about the way you process inflammation, which is a hot topic in the nutrition and health world today because it relates to so many other chronic conditions. And all of that is controlled by our gut health.
Mm, wow. Yeah. So not to pinpoint just like one specific thing that you said, but I will say and I know you said it's not just about what's in the toilet. I completely agree. But I feel like I remember learning this when I was in school for dietetics, and I've still kind of used it now. But is there a normal amount of time to go to the bathroom? Because I feel like when I talk to clients, sometimes I will hear them say every, 3 to 4 days. But for them, that's always been the case. Like that's always been their cadence of, bowel movement. So I've always thought to myself, okay, so if that's typical for them, then that's just how they are. But is there a specific amount of bowel movements or cadence of bowel movements that is more normal than others? I'm really kind of veering off track a little bit, but I'm curious.
Oh, I think this is perfectly on track. The technical, official, optimal is 1 to 3 bowel movements per day, every day. Now, I am the first to say that health is individual and what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for the other person and all those kinds of things. So part of me wants to believe what you say. If someone goes every 4 days and that's how they've always been, fine. But at the same time, our gut and our bowels are one of the main ways that we detoxify. I'm not talking, master cleanse or any of that stuff. I'm talking about true detoxification that we all do. Our livers and our kidneys and our sweat and our urine and our poop, all of that is detoxifying us on a daily basis. And without that great detoxification, it's very hard for our body to operate effectively. I find people, even if they've been going only once every 4 days since they were kids, once we get them to go, maybe it's for them once a day or maybe every other day, but it's more frequent. Mm-hmm. They just feel so much more energized. They feel kind of like cleaner, almost like just bouncing through the day as opposed to being weighed down. It is actually heavy. If you imagine how much food you're eating, I know I'm a volume eater. I eat a lot of great, delicious foods. If all of that is sitting in my abdomen for 4 days, ooh, that just feels uncomfortable to me.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. And that does make so much sense. I've always thought that too. Clearly, this is not my area of expertise, but I've always thought that when people say that, yeah, if it's always what you've been doing, yeah, you're kind of like used to that. That's just how you operate. But to your point, maybe they could feel even better. So yeah, I think that's good information. Okay, so having a healthy gut is helpful, as we know, in the short term. But can you talk a little bit about, and I know you've already kind of alluded to this a little bit, but what about long term? So what are the benefits of having a healthy, well-oiled machine long-term? Yes. Like, are there chronic conditions, maybe cancer, for example, that we're less prone to develop with a healthy gut?
Yeah, I think since you threw out cancer, it's very difficult. I'm certainly not going to be the one to say one thing causes cancer. Right. We're definitely not there yet in the research, so I'm very much not saying if you only poop once a week, you're going to get cancer. Absolutely not. However, we do know that a lot of these inflammatory conditions, maybe cancer being one of them, and diabetes, metabolic syndrome, dementia, cognitive decline, you name it, so many of these things are related to inflammation. If we don't have good gut health, we're not able to process that inflammation appropriately. And so I do believe that having adverse gut health over a long period of time, not if you get constipated once on a trip or something like that, but a long period of time could lead to an increased incidence of some of these things. And it's not just my belief. The research backs that up for sure.
Yeah.
There are also a lot of the good bacteria that live in our digestive tract that have a lot of other functions aside from just chewing up the fiber we eat or whatever. They actually help us produce and absorb many nutrients like vitamins, minerals, things like that. They play an essential role in the digestion, absorption, and even creation of some of those nutrients. So things like nutrient deficiencies can happen if we don't have the right gut bacteria to actually help absorb that stuff. And nutrient deficiencies, I mean, goodness, there are so many implications of that.
Mm-hmm.
But then also what we mentioned before with the mental health is always one of the most motivating to me as someone who has dealt with anxiety and all kinds of other things. I always think that anything that I can do for my brain and my mental health, I am all about it. And so my gut health is directly linked to that with the vagus nerve, which is the largest cranial nerve in our body between our brain and our gut. If my gut's not healthy, my mind is not going to be healthy in the long term. All of these things are much more important than, ooh, I feel constipated one day. It's this long-term stuff that oftentimes gets people to really focus on their gut health.
Yeah. And I guess I'm just thinking if there's anyone listening and they're like, oh, I've had IBS my entire life. And does that mean that I'm at higher risk for all these things? What would you say to someone who has always had a condition like IBS or IBD? Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah. How is that affecting them if they're not getting help? I mean, yeah.
That's right. I know where you're going. One of my favorite quotes is a Chinese proverb that says, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that for cases when people say, I've had IBS for 20 years or whatever. Well, yeah. I mean, would it have been optimal to fix your gut health 20 years ago? Of course. But there's nothing we can do about it. So let's not stress. There's so much shame and guilt and fear and all this stuff in the health world. I do not want to add to any of that. And I know for sure, based on the research, that as people improve their gut health now, their future health improves. So it's not like once you've had bad gut health, you're doomed for the rest of life. Let's just use that as motivation to change it now. And IBS, which is what you brought up, it's actually a diagnosis of exclusion. So basically what IBS means is, ooh, we ran a bunch of tests on you. Nothing is, quote, wrong. Like you don't have Crohn's or colitis or something like that, but you still have funky digestion. So let's slap a diagnosis of IBS on you. That's like a blanket, something's wrong, but we don't really know what. And whenever we have those blanket diagnoses, I think we just haven't yet found the root cause, but there is a root cause. So it's an exciting opportunity to just dig a little deeper.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I always get silently frustrated when I have a client who says, oh yeah, I've been diagnosed with IBS. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, I don't know. What does that mean to the doctor who diagnosed you? Like, what are they doing about it? And then, yeah, it's, you're right. It's like,
I totally agree.
Yeah. And why am I having it? It's more like a symptom, you know?
Yes.
So, okay, let's move on to the food / the diet. So day to day, what are some things that we can be doing, or I guess eating, putting into our body to support a healthy gut? And I'm actually going to be doing a whole podcast on probiotics, I think right after this one comes out, because April
Amazing.
Is National IBS Month or something. Pretty sure. Speaking of IBS,
Great.
April is something.
Okay.
But can you maybe talk to probiotics a little bit? I know that's a big topic, which is why I'm doing a whole episode on it. But yeah, what can we be doing eating to support a healthy gut?
Sure. So I'm always going to start with fiber. I guess it's obvious given that my second favorite food was Brussels sprouts, but I'm a huge proponent of fiber from whole foods for almost everyone. I say almost everyone because if you are in a state of extreme gut distress, then too much fiber can be too rough on you.
Yeah.
We have to heal your gut and maybe cool off from the raw vegetables for a little while and do vegetables from pureed soups or smoothies or really cooked, what I call hammered vegetables, kind of like mushy zucchini or something like that. Mm-hmm. But for someone with a moderately to very healthy gut, fiber is always going to be the best. When we eat fiber, it's actually undigestible. Some types of fiber are undigestible through the stomach and the small intestine. Then it gets to the colon, and the bacteria in your colon eat the fiber, and they produce something called short-chain fatty acids, which is like, I don't know, aloe vera for your gut. It's very soothing for your gut. It's a great gut healing repair byproduct of us eating fiber. So fiber is very important. Also, minimizing anything that we know causes us gut irritation. So for example, for me, ice cream just makes me feel really not great physically. I feel bloated and I'm on the toilet too much the next day and all kinds of stuff. So that doesn't mean that I don't have ice cream ever. It means that I definitely choose not to have ice cream on a daily basis because it makes me feel bad and I love myself enough to want to feel good. So anything that you know is causing you digestive upset, just about being strategic and choosing when and whether that's worth it. But then you also mentioned probiotics, and probiotics are so essential to keep those healthy gut bacteria strong and keep them in the right balance. And we can get probiotics from food.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years ago, people would get probiotics from kimchi and sauerkraut and kefir and yogurt and miso and other fermented foods. And they did great with just eating those. If you look at almost every traditional culture, they have some kind of fermented food in their history that's a key part of their traditional diet. The problem is that today we have so many things that deplete probiotics, like stress, number one, antibiotics, which I'm not an anti-medicine person, but it's a fact that we are over-prescribed antibiotics. I know many people, I probably had 25 courses during my childhood, or maybe more, I don't know. So that depletes our gut health. A lot of processed food, preservatives, chemical additives, too much sugar, too much caffeine even, like all these things can deplete our gut bacteria. So it's my belief that most of us cannot get enough probiotics just from our food these days. I take a probiotic supplement, and I have a lot of my clients do so as well. The exception might be like someone living on a farm, cooking or growing their own vegetables, cooking their food, not a lot of processed food, not a lot of stress, not a lot of pollution, not a lot of screen time. Great. They probably don't need a probiotic, but I do. I'm not quite living in that world yet. Mm-hmm. And I think the last part of your question was, how do I choose the right one?
Yeah.
It's going to be a different answer in 10 years. I think we are on the precipice of more personalized gut health, and we're not there yet. I run a test out of my practice called the Gut Zoomer, which assesses like 90 different strains of bacteria in a person and tells them how deficient or abundant they are in different species. And that's cool. But one, that's very expensive. It's not accessible to the average person. And two, it's not the whole gamut of bacteria. It's just a sample of what they deem to be important ones. And I think that's changing. I really think that 10 years from now, it'll be like a $5 test. We all just know what bacteria we need. We can get that. That's really cool. In the meantime, though, I would look at the back of a probiotic bottle and try to look for as many strains as possible. So if they have these words in italics like Lactobacillus acidophilus or Saccharomyces boulardii or Bifidobacterium, whatever, like all these kind of funky sounding words, just try to get a variety of those. That's a good bet. And then pay attention to if it says it's refrigerated, keep it in the refrigerator. If it says it's not, then that's great. Obviously, you can keep it wherever. There are lots of other things to look at, but since you're doing a whole podcast episode, I'll leave it there and see what you think or what you want to add on.
No, I think that's actually very helpful, because that's where I get caught up, especially recommending probiotics to those I work with. Because you're right. I mean, first of all, this is a field that is just expanding by the literal second. And I think yes, you're right. In 10 years, there are probably going to be different recommendations and different products. But what can we do now with the research that we know now? And just from what I've found, there's never... Very rarely do I see a probiotic recommended just for general health. Like it's usually right, like for a traveler's diarrhea or IBS, right, or, you know, and so I'm always like, is it even necessary? Do we need these? But I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. We're not getting enough in our food. And even just getting, even if we don't know exactly what kind of probiotics we need, putting some good bacteria in our gut is not going to hurt.
Absolutely agree.
Right.
It's really cool when they start to look at the mechanism of action. Some people think that even if the probiotic, like the bacteria in the capsule you ingest, is dead, like no longer an active culture, mm-hmm, your body can still respond to that and have a productive gut health response. So I don't even think we know the benefits of probiotics yet. I think it's such an exciting field and why I love staying on top of it. And I know you do too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very fascinating. More to come. Okay. So yes, I'm going to go a little bit out of order on our questions here, because my last question was about, really, you know, we hear a lot of things in the media about how to achieve gut health through, you know, restricting and omitting different foods. But
yes,
how can we keep our gut as healthy as can be, but still remain neutral in our thoughts about food and not get sucked into this idea of restriction? Because I know you mentioned, and you're exactly right, I agree with you. Our diet, it's not even just about our diet, but also the prescription of antibiotics. There's so much, you know, where we're growing up, our environment, but it's really hard not to think, oh, I shouldn't eat this or I shouldn't eat that. How do we prevent that from happening? Yeah.
Yeah, I think part of it is the way we think about it and the words that we choose to use. So for example, in my instance with ice cream, I never say to myself, ice cream's bad. Oh my gosh, ice cream has too much calories or anything like I shouldn't have ice cream. None of those words, bad, shouldn't, any of that kind of stuff, I think is generally unproductive. But I frame it instead as a choice. It is genuinely my choice to have ice cream. And if I do, I'm going to enjoy every bite of it. And I know I'm going to have digestive upset the next day. That's my choice. And I even think it's someone's choice for their long-term health. If they want to make the choices that are not optimal for their long-term health, I mean, I could sit here and tell you why I feel motivated to make choices for my long-term health. But every person has a choice. When we frame that to ourselves, it feels a lot better than restriction. And the other part of this, I think, is even more motivating to people, which is it's all about the balance. There is no one food that's causing you to have bad gut health. Unless you have true celiac disease, then I would definitely say it's not a good idea for you to ever have gluten, or you have an anaphylactic peanut response or something, of course, like it's not a good idea to ever have peanuts. But otherwise, there's no one food that's causing it. It's really about the balance of inflammation that we preserve in our guts. And so I think of this like a cup. If you imagine a cup that's halfway full of water, we just don't want it to overflow. When it overflows, we have poor gut health and we might have those IBS-like symptoms or bloating or something like that. And some people are really lucky. They they are born with a cup that has very little liquid in the cup. And then they have a lot of things that they can do. They can eat inflammatory foods, like maybe it is. I don't want to demonize any food, but maybe it's something with added sugar. Or maybe it's a fried food or something like that. They can eat some and their cup still doesn't overflow. That's awesome. Some other people, they might be born with a cup that's more full. Their inflammation set point is higher. And then for them, it takes a little more balancing. So we think of anti-inflammatory foods like vegetables, fruits, healthy fats, lots of water, stress management, all that kind of stuff. So if those people are going to eat some more inflammatory foods, they just need to be extra cautious about making sure they're drinking enough water, making sure they're getting in some extra vegetables during the day, maybe taking a beat to take some deep breath, something like that. And as long as they keep their inflammation balance in mind, they're going to be fine too. And that kind of relieves the pressure off people to say, I can never have dairy or I can never have sugar or anything like that. Yeah. No, it's really just about the balance and keeping in mind the choice that you have to make yourself feel really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm nodding my head throughout everything that you're saying. I remember, so I don't know if you knew this, but I used to do this podcast with another dietitian. Her name was Nicole. And she used to always say, our body looks at averages. And I love that because it's true. Our body does not judge us on one meal or one day of eating or one week of eating. It's all really about dietary patterns over time. And I actually have an Etsy shop where I have decals. And one of my, I swear I came up with this quote. If I stole this from anyone, please let me know. But here's my quote. It says, healthy eating isn't perfect and perfect eating isn't healthy. I've been saying this for years.
I love that.
But it is so true. And it just kind of describes everything that you just said. We cannot overthink. Quite honestly, overthinking our food choices has the opposite effect, and it causes stress, which then can hurt our immune system and our gut, as you were saying. So just like you said, don't overthink it. If you know something doesn't feel great for you, but you want to eat it anyway, give yourself permission to do that, just knowing what's going to happen later, but also knowing that maybe you won't eat it again in a while. Permission and, staying in touch with how your body feels, that is all wrapped up in what you just said. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
You mentioned bloating, and so I'm glad that you mentioned that, because this is kind of how I'm going to wrap up this interview. Because I think, here's the thing, bloating as a description is something that I hear from just about everyone that I work with one-on-one, and I feel like it's become just ubiquitous. So what does it actually mean to be bloated? What does it feel like? Which I realize it feels different for everyone, but like in general, and is being bloated normal?
Great question. So I like to refer to some non-technical terms, but they tend to make it clear for people what they're experiencing. So the first one is balloon bloating, where it just feels like there's a balloon in your abdomen, where if you kind of like press in, it almost feels like there's just air in there. And if you were able to burp or pass gas or whatever you want to do to get it out, it would all be better, but you can't do that. It's like stuck in there. Mm-hmm. And this is often caused by people not chewing adequately, which sounds like the most elementary solution, but I promise you, for so many people who think that they've had this extreme genetic bloating issue for all their lives, and then I just have them eat in a relaxed state and chew their food really well, they can actually reduce this type of bloating. Hmm. It also could be something like SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, where kind of the bacteria from your colon take a vacation upwards into your small intestine, and that can cause some upper GI, airy, bloating type distension. That can be uncomfortable as well. But the balloon bloating is very different from what I call the heavy bloating, which is, I just feel like that food is sitting in the pit of my stomach and it just keeps like weighing me down there. And that's usually due to constipation, which we don't have enough fiber or water or even movement, like physically moving your body during the day can help with constipation. Fear, believe it or not, like emotional fear can lead to constipation. So all these kinds of things. Or it could be lack of digestive enzymes. We have all of these digestive enzymes that are supposed to help us break down food chemically. And if we get those depleted based on stress usually or a variety of other conditions, then the food can just kind of sit there more heavily. So those are types of bloating. But then a lot of people use bloating when they're saying, oh, like my pants just aren't fitting very well lately. Maybe it's some of the food choices that I've been making or my body's going through changes. That's not real bloating. Bloating is something that comes and goes. It's a response to food. It either feels like that airy balloon feeling or that heavy pit of the stomach feeling. That's bloating. And for your last question, which is it normal? I mean, it is normal to have your body physically change during the day. So generally, if we wake up in the morning, maybe we go to the bathroom, we get rid of some stuff, our body looks different. Our pants might fit different in the morning than in the evening when we've had three meals and however many snacks and drank a lot of water, hopefully, and all of this kind of stuff. There's just food there. Your body will physically change. That's totally normal. But to have this feeling of discomfort, pain, pressing on your stomach, and it feels like there's a balloon, lots of bloating, lots of burping, belching, any kind of like extreme discomfort or gurgling, that's not normal. And those are all signs that you could improve your gut health.
Okay. That is so, so helpful. What about, and this is something else I hear, people will tell me I'm bloated every time I eat. And sometimes I think, okay, maybe that's true, but also maybe they're just confusing bloat with fullness. So can you talk a little bit about how to differentiate the two?
Yes. So I ask those people, do you ever eat anything that doesn't make you feel this way? Like, could you drink some water and not feel that way? Or maybe you drink a smoothie and you don't feel that way or something like that. Or maybe you eat, I don't know what it is, a banana and you don't feel that way. If it's only happening in response to some types of foods, it might be a real response that it's not just fullness from a meal, that they're having something like lack of digestive enzymes, which I mentioned. That's a really common one. when people don't have digestive enzymes, they can't break down protein and fat very well. And almost all of our meals hopefully contain protein and fat. And so if you're feeling like that mostly after every meal, it might really be a sign of true bloating and not fullness. But if you never have anything to eat and you never feel that way, then it's probably just fullness, which is a normal sensation. Obviously, we want to feel full. It could be the case in that situation that someone has not yet learned their hunger and fullness cues and they're eating till they're over full.
Yeah.
So I love the Japanese saying harahachibu, which means essentially like 80% full. We don't want that Thanksgiving Day feeling every single meal. That's too full. That's over full. We just want to be like pleasantly satiated. And does that feel like there's something in your stomach? Yes, because there actually is. You ate food. Of course it goes there. That's a good feeling. We just don't want to feel like, ugh, I need a nap or I need to unbutton my pants after every single meal. That's not comfortable.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think sometimes when I'm working with people, I find that they're not even used to eating to fullness. So maybe they're just eating a bunch of snacks throughout the day and they never actually sit down for a meal, like you said, and eat it mindfully and focusing on the food and the enjoyment. And yes, when I start working with them and they start maybe eating a little bit more, then it, like this feeling is uncomfortable, but it's actually just this feeling of fullness that they've never experienced before, or they've experienced it, but not very often.
Yes.
So it's foreign. And yeah, I think there's a lot of good questions there, but that description of the different types of bloat, super, super helpful. You know, going back to what I talked about at the beginning with the FODMAPs, I know that's something I still talk to people about because FODMAPs can be a problem with someone with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It can be a problem with people who don't even have SIBO, who just have, you know, IBS. You know, I'm kind of going to go rogue here for a second. What about gas? Like, is gas normal? Because this is something that I've seen back and forth answers in the research about, like, how much gas is normal? Or is there a normal?
So I actually think there is. Who knows why these statistics stick in my head? But I read a study that said that the average person, like the normal healthy gut person, passes gas 21 times a day.
Oh.
So that's normal, supposedly. Okay. And I am not suggesting anyone sit there and count. And if it's 22, they panic or anything like that.
Right, right.
But know that it happens. Now, if it's like loud and explosive or super smelly or uncomfortable, like you feel like you can't have relief until that happens, all of that is not normal. The gas happens when those bacteria are eating up the insoluble fiber, the undigestible fiber. Those bacteria are creating gas. And that's actually a good sign that, you know, you're eating enough fiber, and that's good. It's why beans can tend to be a little gaseous, or cruciferous vegetables or something like that. But people know, if you're worried about sitting in a meeting and not being able to control yourself because you have some smelly gas problems or anything like that, that's not normal. And that's a sign that there's some repair to be done on your gut.
And would probiotics be a good place to start?
So I think yes for the average person, but since now we both mentioned SIBO, I will say if you take probiotics and you feel worse, then stop. That's probably or very well could be a sign of SIBO, and you're just feeding those guys in your small intestine, unless you're getting the right strain, a specific strain of bacteria, or maybe like a Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a yeast that could be beneficial for SIBO. But the average probiotic might make it worse. Most people, though, don't have SIBO. So I think probiotics are a really good place to start. Making sure you're having adequate water during the day, making sure you're chewing your food really well. I just can't stress that enough. People don't even chew. When I ask them to start chewing, they think it's such a pain because it takes longer. But unfortunately, we're not supposed to eat a meal in 90 seconds. We're supposed to sit there and chew it and really partially digest it in our mouth. If we don't, that definitely contributes to gas.
Yeah, that's such a good tip. And that's something that rarely think about as a clinician. I do talk with people, obviously, a lot about not getting too hungry, because what happens when we get too hungry? That's when we eat really fast. But just the whole idea of taking more bites and actually making your food into, I guess, what is it called? Like, clinically, a bolus, not swallowing it whole, half digesting it. Yeah, you're maybe not half, but yeah, you're right. The digestion starts in your mouth, and that's an important piece of the digestion process.
Yes. So,
good. Okay. Well, that is all the questions I had. This has been incredibly helpful, and I think so interesting. I would honestly love to talk to you way more. So maybe we'll have a part two, but for now,
I would love that.
Okay, great. Where can listeners find you?
I always direct people to my website. It has everything there if you want the podcast or Instagram or blog or any of my programming. I would head to thelionsshare.org. It's L-Y-O-N-S, lionsshare.org. And I would love to connect with anyone listening.
Awesome. And I will put all those links in the show notes. So if anyone is interested, I'll put your Instagram in there as well. Megan, thank you so much for your time. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much. I've had a great time and I look forward to talking again.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Hopefully you enjoyed that interview again as much as I did. Megan was just so knowledgeable, and I'm already planning on having her back on because she's just so, I mean, just so full of knowledge. And, you know, sometimes even though I am a dietitian, it's just really good to get different perspectives and also to catch up on areas of nutrition that I might be lacking in. It is really hard as a dietitian to know a lot about many different things. So I feel like I'm one of those RDs who knows a little about a lot, which I think is completely fine. There are certain areas that I know a lot about, but, you know, as a dietitian, especially where I work, I have to know a little about a lot. And I think gut health is one of those things where I know a little about it enough to help the general public and to help, you know, especially those who follow a low FODMAP diet. I can certainly help with that. But when it comes to deeper issues with gut health, I really appreciate having someone like Megan and others like her who know more in-depth details about really how to heal the gut, other than the very basic recommendations. So it's just always so good to learn from other people in the nutrition field, because I know I do not know everything and there's always something for me to learn. So hopefully you learned some things from Megan and you enjoyed that as much as I did. All right, I'm going to go ahead and dive into my favorite new product or recipes. I made this amazing lentil and sweet potato soup with coconut milk. Let me tell you, it was a one pot dish with, again, potatoes, lentils, coconut, ginger, garlic. I will put the recipe in my show notes here. Not only did I love it, but believe it or not, even the kids, I shouldn't say they loved it, but they tried it and didn't hate it. So I will be making this again because I think that was a good start. They're not huge soup fans unless it's just like a chicken noodle soup. So the fact that they tried this, it actually, Paige, I think, even had multiple bites, was a win for me. But a really, really delicious recipe, super nutrient dense and super easy, which is, I think, the trifecta when it comes to recipes. All right, that's it for today. Coming up on April 8th, I will be talking about body connection, why it's important, and how we can improve it. Until then, treat yourself with the respect you deserve, be the best friend you've always wanted, and reach out to me at any time on Instagram at nutritionunmeasured or via email at trustyourbodyrd@gmail.com.